Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Joe Lynham, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 20th of November, these are our main stories. A US security expert has told the impeachment inquiry into Donald Trump the president acted improperly by making political demands of Ukraine. There's no clear winner in Britain's first televised election debate, in which the leaders of the two biggest parties clashed repeatedly on Brexit and austerity. Amnesty International says it's confirmed the deaths of more than 100 people in Iran since protests broke out last week. Also in this podcast...
When you fall across, you should try to fold them so that they will be able to stand upright on their own.
The Japanese lifestyle guru Marie Kondo has built her reputation on getting people to tidy up and throw out unnecessary items. But what would minimalists think of her new venture? The impeachment inquiry into Donald Trump has been holding further televised hearings, with an administration official accusing the president of making improper political demands of his Ukrainian counterpart. Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman said a phone call in July, during which Mr. Trump asked the Ukrainian leader Volodymyr Zelensky to investigate his political rival Joe Biden, was inappropriate. Colonel Vindman said that he'd raised the call with a lawyer on the National Security Council, John Eisenberg.
I listened on the call in the Situation Room with White House colleagues. I was concerned by the call. What I heard was inappropriate, and I reported my concerns to Mr. Eisenberg. It is improper for the President of the United States to demand a foreign government investigate a U.S. citizen and a political opponent.
Republican members of the House Intelligence Committee appeared to question the loyalty of Colonel Vindman, who was injured during the Iraq War. Speaking at the White House, President Trump described the impeachment hearings in this way.
Right now, you have a kangaroo court headed by little Shifty Schiff, where we don't have lawyers, we don't have witnesses, we don't have anything, and yet I just got to watch, and the Republicans are absolutely killing it. They are doing so well, because it's a scam. It's a big scam.
Also testifying, Kurt Volker, President Trump's former special envoy to Ukraine. He told the inquiry he was never aware of an effort to urge Ukraine to investigate the former Vice President Biden.
As you know from the extensive real-time documentation I have provided, Vice President Biden was not a topic of our discussions. I was not on the July 25th phone call between President Trump and President Zelensky. I was not made aware of any reference to Vice President Biden or his son by President Trump, until the transcript of that call was released on September 25th, 2019.
Kurt Volker. Tim Franks heard more from the BBC's Alim Makboul, who listened to Tuesday's proceedings.
It's been an interesting day because Donald Trump and the Republicans have been portraying this whole process as something that's very biased, that those coming out against the president are all sort of never-Trumpers. And yet this morning, in the testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, who you mentioned, and also from a lady called Jennifer Williams, who worked for the Vice President, Mike Pence, we had two people who didn't really fit that profile. Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, for example, is a decorated war hero, a veteran who's still working for the White House. And it just gave us a sense of the kind of risks that people were taking to come out and do, as he said, simply tell the truth. And what he was saying is one of the people who was on this now notorious call between Donald Trump and his Ukrainian counterpart was that he immediately felt that something improper was going on, that somehow Donald Trump was urging the Ukrainians to start an investigation into the family, into the son of Joe Biden, and he immediately felt that he had to report that. You got the sense from him what a risk he was taking as someone who still works at the White House to come out and testify against, as it was put to him, the most powerful man in the world.
And in terms of Kurt Volker, he's a key witness, isn't he? Because he is alleged to be one of these three amigos, as they're described, who was involved in creating a shadow Ukraine policy. What's he had to say, if anything, about that?
Well, he talked about himself as being the official channel and one of the key men who sort of shaped Donald Trump's Ukraine policy as special envoy to Ukraine. And it is interesting because while Donald Trump says this whole process is a sham or a scam, as he said it earlier today in a cabinet meeting, you know, we do have somebody here who says, well, I was involved in all the discussions and I didn't know that Donald Trump was pressing Ukraine to start this investigation or it wouldn't get military aid. But his testimony we hear is more nuanced than that, and we may hear still some damning evidence that potentially not everything was done correctly.
Alim Makbul. The rights group Amnesty International says it's been able to confirm that 106 people have died in Iran during 5 days of protests, but it believes the real number is much higher. Video material appears to show security forces shooting at demonstrators. Unrest broke out across the country following a sharp rise in petrol prices. Earlier, a UN human rights spokesman in Geneva, Rupert Colville, expressed his concern over the violence.
We're deeply concerned by reported violations of international norms and standards on the use of force, including the firing of live ammunition against demonstrators in Iran during the protests that began on Friday and have continued into this week.
Iran's supreme leader said the upheaval had not been the result of popular protest. He blamed enemies and declared victory over them. Our correspondent Paul Adams reports.
When protests erupted across Iran last Friday, the internet was flooded with images. But over the weekend, the authorities shut down the internet and mobile phone networks, making it much harder to see what was happening. The UN and human rights organizations have been collecting data and now say they believe scores of people have been killed in a widespread crackdown. Amnesty International says it's documented 106 fatalities and says the real number may be much higher. Its researchers have seen video of riot police smashing the windows of cars with the drivers still inside and have spoken to eyewitnesses who say snipers have been used to shoot from rooftops. Iran state media has reported none of this, but says more than 1,000 protesters have been arrested.
Paul Adams. Two New York prison guards who were on duty on the night in August that the convicted U.S. sex offender Jeffrey Epstein killed himself have been charged with falsifying records. The two men are now themselves in custody. From New York, Nick Bryant reports.
Jeffrey Epstein's dead body was found in one of the most heavily protected jailhouses in America, a correctional facility in the heart of Lower Manhattan, where he'd been housed in a special unit because of a previous attempt to take his life. His cell should have been monitored once every 30 minutes, but two guards have been charged with repeatedly failing to carry out those mandatory checks from 10:30 in the evening to 6:30 in the morning when they discovered the sex offender's lifeless body. Tova Noel and Michael Thomas have been charged with conspiring to make up false records to hide their dereliction. The two guards had evidently spent the night surfing the internet, sat at their desk, and at times sleeping. Video surveillance showed that no one had entered the special unit all night, an important detail that negates some of the conspiracy theories that have claimed the billionaire was murdered.
Nick Bryant in New York. Prosecutors in Stockholm have dropped rape charges against the founder of WikiLeaks, Julian Assange. Sweden had sought Mr. Assange for allegations of sexual assault for 9 years. Assange, who has consistently denied the allegations, avoided attempts by the Swedish authorities to extradite him by seeking refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. But Mr. Assange will remain in jail in Britain on bail violations and is still wanted by the US for leaking national security secrets. In a moment, we'll look at the wider context of this decision, but first, here's our reporter in Sweden, Maddie Savage.
It's now almost a decade since prosecutors here first issued an arrest warrant to question Julian Assange, following claims he sexually assaulted one woman and raped another while he was on a speaking tour in Sweden. They ran out of time to look into the allegations of sexual assault due to a 5-year time limit in Sweden, and later dropped their investigation into the alleged rape, saying it was too difficult while the WikiLeaks founder was inside the Ecuadorian embassy in London. After he was removed and arrested in May, they reopened the case. Today, though, Sweden's Deputy Director of Public Prosecutions, Eva-Marie Persson, said that while the woman's account of what happened was credible and reliable, the supporting evidence wasn't strong enough. Prosecutors re-interviewed 5 witnesses and spoke to 2 new ones, but said the length of time that had passed since the allegations and the global media coverage may have affected the way they remembered things. A Swedish official explained that decision.
I have therefore, after careful consideration, come to the conclusion that additional interviews with Julian Assange would not alter the evidentiary basis in a decisive manner. Therefore, I've decided to not take further steps in order to be able to hold an interview with Mr. Julian Assange.
Debates about earlier delays are now resurfacing, and an internal investigation into the way the case was handled hasn't been ruled out. In a statement, a lawyer for one of Julian Assange's accusers has said her client was sad and disappointed by the decision and would now consider whether to appeal against it.
Maddie Savage. Julian Assange worked with the former US security expert Edward Snowden to release highly sensitive information about US foreign policy, including the deliberate targeting of individuals in Iraq and Afghanistan. He also leaked embarrassing emails from within the Democratic Party in 2016, which some believe helped Donald Trump into the White House. But it was his six-year-long stay in the Ecuadorian embassy in London which brought him global notoriety. Caroline Hawley has been following the case.
With the end of his legal troubles in Sweden, one long chapter in the Julian Assange saga is over. But another one, in the United States, has barely begun. The WikiLeaks founder always argued it was because of his fear of being extradited from Sweden to the US that he took refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy in London and claimed asylum. That political refuge ended unceremoniously in April, when he was dragged out of the embassy by British police. The following month, he was sentenced to 50 weeks in jail for breaching bail back in 2010. And in June, the then Home Secretary, Sajid Javid, signed an extradition request from the United States, which is now before the courts. Julian Assange faces 18 criminal charges in the USA, including conspiring to hack government computers and violating espionage laws. If convicted, he could face decades in jail.
Light them all up.
Come on, fire!
This was a classified US military video published by WikiLeaks in 2010, showing a helicopter attack in Baghdad which killed civilians. A vast cache of military and diplomatic cables followed, and in 2016, WikiLeaks released hacked emails from the Democratic Party. A full extradition hearing is due to take place at Westminster Magistrates Court in central London in February. From behind bars in Belmarsh Jail, Julian Assange is trying to prepare for the case. The decision by Swedish prosecutors means there'll now be no competing extradition request to the one from the United States.
Caroline Hawley. Now, could Google be about to change the world of gaming? The tech giant has launched its gaming service Stadia, which allows gamers to play the latest titles as long as they have a decent broadband connection and a Google Chrome browser. It could be the end for physical games consoles. Phil Harrison is in charge of the project.
I don't think what we're doing is particularly revolutionary when you consider what's happened in the music, television and film industries, that they have moved from being packaged goods, discs, CDs, DVDs, to almost exclusively an online and streaming experience. And I don't claim that this innovation is going to change the world overnight, but I think this is the direction of travel and that this will be a very strong future for the games industry to create these kind of streaming experiences. And also, we're not the only ones thinking about this as well.
Razia Iqbal spoke to Lee Milner, the presenter of the BBC podcast Naked Gaming.
So usually, if you're into your gaming like me, you'll either have an Xbox or PlayStation or Nintendo, basically a console. What Google Stadia is offering is no console at all, just a tiny little receiver about the same size as the palm of your hand, along with a controller. That way you can stream games straight into your telly or your phone, anything really, with a screen. Now, what makes this really impressive is that no other gaming company is offering this just yet. Although it is worth saying, it's not like Netflix where you pay for a subscription and you get unlimited access. You will still have to pay for your games. You just won't have to wait for them to download. They'll be instant, like most things these days.
And when you say, you know, that Google Stadia are doing something that no one else has done before, why is it possible that they can and others haven't?
That's interesting because this technology is phenomenal. It's going to make history if it works. You know, streaming films is one thing, but streaming games from your bedroom in real time with no delays, that's pretty incredible. About 10 other companies have tried this in the past and failed miserably, but Google is the first one to release it.
So you said that if it works, I wonder whether, I mean, they're obviously in a testing phase with this. What are the kinds of problems that might emerge that will make everyone pause and say, oh, actually, the technology isn't quite there yet?
Yeah, I mentioned earlier 10 other companies have tried this, and one in particular called OnLive tried this a couple of years ago, and it actually worked for a few years, but then it just collapsed. It couldn't cope with all the streaming and trying to eject and trying to play those games. You know, if this technology works, it could well change the way we game forever. But if not, it could crash out of the market. Remember, gamers like games to be fast, smooth and reliable. I mean, I'm playing Pokemon at the minute on my Nintendo Switch. You know, I've got my score bunny, which is like a bit of a Pikachu, to level 10. If I lost that data, I would be absolutely gutted. And this is the problem that Google faces. If it crashes in, you know, in a year's time or 5 years' time and all that data is lost, you know, not only is it going to upset gamers, but what happens to that data? We've seen massive companies in the past who've had problems with data, keeping that privacy settings, you know, locked. And what could happen? We could see what's happened with Facebook before, people's passwords leaked, people's bank details leaked. Hopefully, though, this will be very secure.
And you're excited at the prospect of this, are you?
Do I sound excited? Yes, I am. I am excited, yeah. You know, I love gaming, and to be able to stream them would be good. Am I sceptical? Yes, a lot of things can go wrong with this. And I think it's going to be hard to turn people like me who love the PlayStation or who love the Xbox, who are loyal supporters, who probably won't drift away from, you know, their trusted console.
Lee Milner from the BBC podcast Naked Gaming. Here's news of another podcast from the BBC World Service.
Hi, I'm Kalki Keklan, and I'm back for another season of My Indian Life. My Indian Life is the BBC World Service podcast that brings you real-life stories from young people in India.
I want to be the first human on Mars, so let me make that happen and set that as a goal for myself.
They're sometimes raw.
This wasn't just me being a victim. You know, it was a lot of people who were suffering.
They're sometimes uplifting.
At no point do you get upset?
No.
Never.
I don't get upset.
And they are always a fascinating listen.
I feel kind of proud that I managed to convince people to take me seriously.
That's Kalki Presents My Indian Life.
What is the point of just complaining? If you want to do something, do something.
There's a teaser for the second season available now. Just search for My Indian Life wherever you get your podcasts.
In Hong Kong, the siege at this stage seems almost over. Only a few dozen protesters are still thought to be inside the Polytechnic University, which has been surrounded by the police since Sunday. More than 1,000 people have been arrested. Some of those still inside were so desperate to escape, they tried to flee through sewers. From Hong Kong, our correspondent Jonathan Head sent this report.
Just a few dozen hardcore protesters remained inside the besieged university campus tonight. One small group did make a late bid for freedom, only to be intercepted by riot police who've surrounded the campus since the weekend. Once again, the tactics have changed on both sides of this five-month-long urban conflict. The protesters, who previously prided themselves on their fast-moving hit-and-run disruptions, this time barricaded themselves in to protect the university, using stockpiles of petrol bombs, bows and arrows, and giant improvised catapults to hurl bricks at the police. For their part, the police determined not to allow any of the protesters to escape, sealing the campus off. This group tried to get out through the underground sewer, but could not find a route. Fear and exhaustion encouraged more of the protesters to surrender, some wrapped in foil blankets and escorted by medics. All face possible charges of rioting, which carries a 10-year prison sentence, though Hong Kong's chief executive, Carrie Lam, who's offered little new to resolve the crisis, did insist that those under 18 should be allowed to return to their homes. The battle for the Polytechnic University, the most dramatic yet, appears to be at an end. But more protests are promised this week, keeping Hong Kong on edge. The treatment of the young activists by the police is often rough these days, sometimes it seems needlessly so. China's insistence now that Hong Kong's famously independent judiciary can no longer interpret the basic law, which is supposed to shape the territory's distinct one-country-two-systems character, can only add to the grievances which have fueled this extraordinary protest movement.
Jonathan Head. One anonymous protester calls himself Mr. P. On Tuesday, he was outside the Hong Kong Polytechnic University and part of a team who were helping protesters leave the area in so-called parent cars. He spoke to the BBC anonymously as he feared that his safety might be compromised. And he told Ben James about the students he picked up and what condition they were in.
They are very tired, as some of them were. They were suffering from water cannons from the water cannon truck, and they are not feeling well and cold, and they need some clean water and food too, and we are just sending them home if there were not many of them outside waiting.
What did they tell you about what it had been like inside?
I mean, inside, they were very upset, and they are just very worried about when the police will just coming in to arrest them, because the police are surrounding there, and they don't get any medical support and any support inside. They are very desperate and sad.
What is it about what they're demonstrating for that attracts you to their cause? What do you want to change in Hong Kong?
We are just, after the extradition law is putting back, they said they don't promote this law anymore, but still we want the real universal suffrage for Hong Kong, as this is the most important thing to have in Hong Kong. Because many problems about the violence and from the police officers, and many or very major and minor problems are from, do you have a responsible government for Hong Kong? So universal suffrages are the thing that we want.
When you're out there in the car driving these protesters home, how do you avoid the police?
We need to look at some scout groups in Telegram to see where the cops are near us or on which road there are roadblocks set by the police. So we need to avoid them during the trip.
So other people are looking out for where the police are in town and they're telling you where they are, and so you can work out which route you can go.
Yeah. There are many scout groups in Telegram.
But still, you must be scared you might run into them. Could you be punished for what you're doing?
Yeah, I will be punished, even though those drivers, only with some food or some clothes for changes, when they are stopped by the police, they are charged for theft, or even their windscreen is broken by when they are stopping by the police. So the police is now furious about even our drivers, as they think we are helping the protesters.
Do you think the protesters have got their tactics right? We've heard about the police use of violence, and that's very, very heavily criticised by many people. But also we've seen protesters stockpiling petrol bombs, we've seen bows and arrows, that kind of thing. Do you think that those are the right tactics, or do you think that they risk losing sympathy from those who would otherwise support them?
Like in June or July, we got very peaceful marches for 1 million and 2 million people. People try to be reasonable and no violence at all day long. But after that, government stopped all the peaceful marches and they banned all those. That's why even then, we can't tell the government to do our sounds, our voices, if we don't use this kind of violence to stop the society from running.
That's a protester in Hong Kong speaking to Ben James. Here in Britain, the first television debate has taken place ahead of the 12th of December election. For an hour, the Conservative Prime Minister Boris Johnson and the opposition Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn went head-to-head answering questions on a variety of topics, including Brexit, of course, the health service and austerity. Mr. Corbyn kicked off with his opening statement, which included a slogan we've heard more than once.
We will build a fairer Britain that cares for all, where wealth and power are shared. The Conservative government is failing. It's failed on the economy, on the climate crisis, the National Health Service, and on Brexit. We can do better than this with a Labour government on your side. A Labour government for the many, not just the few.
Mr. Johnson responded with a phrase he had repeated several times over the course of the debate.
That's the choice. Dither and delay, deadlock and division under a Corbyn-Sturgeon coalition with two referendums, another one on the EU and then another one on Scotland. Or we can end this national misery, break the deadlock, get Brexit done, and make 2020 a year of prosperity and growth.
The final question asked was, what Christmas gift would the party leaders give each other?
Well, I know Mr. Johnson likes a good read. So what I would probably leave under the tree for him would be A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens. And he could... and he can then understand how nasty Scrooge was.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson.
Well, I think what I would probably leave a copy of, since you want a literary effort, a copy of my brilliant Brexit deal.
I spoke to our correspondent, Rob Watson. So, nobody won?
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right, Joe. You're right to ask. But I think it's clear that nobody did win. I think that was the result of the instant polling, and I'm sure of most people who watched it. And I suspect that what the debate will have done was to have confirmed the views that voters had of both men.
What is more important? Corbyn appearing to kind of go toe-to-toe with Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister, or winning? I mean, he's so far behind in the polls, I'm guessing just being there is enough for him at the moment.
Yes, I mean, that's a good way of looking at it. Although I guess the way I would look at it, Joe, is that both men are profoundly unpopular and polarising. And national opinion polls consistently suggest that. What they also suggest is that Mr. Corbyn is even more unpopular than Mr. Johnson. Will he have done anything to sort of close the unpopularity gap, if I could put it that way? I suspect not. And it was really palpable, actually, I thought, Joe, how the audience reflected that sort of, what I guess you would describe, the national distrust and scepticism towards both men, because both were laughed at, Mr. Johnson when he said that he believed in truth, and Mr. Corbyn when he said that Labour's position on Brexit was clear.
Very briefly, what's your assessment of this election so far? Nasty, boring or embarrassing?
Those things, but I think more profoundly that it's just utterly failed to live up to the enormous stakes. I mean, everyone agrees this is a profoundly important moment in British history, and so far the campaigns have not lived up to that.
Rob Watson. Staying in Britain, there are calls for a rethink of how old age is measured and defined. The Office for National Statistics says with people living into their 80s and beyond, 70 could be seen as the new 65. Our health reporter Michelle Roberts explains.
65 has traditionally been taken as the entry point into old age, perhaps because it's the official retirement age for men. But working patterns are shifting and the pension age is rising for both men and women. Now the Office for National Statistics says we should redefine what old looks like. People are living longer, healthier lives, and that means we should consider the years people have ahead of them rather than how old they are according to their birth date. The team looked at health and life expectancy trends over time and say 70 can now be seen as the new 65. That's because many people who reach this milestone can still expect to live another 15 years, something that 65-year-olds could expect back in 1997. But Libby Webb, Senior Research Manager at the charity Age UK, says age is more complex than a number.
What today's analysis tells us about is increases in the averages across the population in the UK. What it doesn't tell us about is individual variation, and age 70 doesn't mean the same thing to everybody.
Experts say even though life expectancy has improved, many people still get ill health towards the end of life, and we haven't yet found a way to combat that.
Michelle Roberts. The Japanese lifestyle guru Marie Kondo has built her reputation and her fortune on getting people to tidy up and throw out unnecessary items. She's now changed tack somewhat. She's launched an online store that sells stuff that you may or may not need at home. Michael Bristow looks at her new venture.
When you fold clothes, you should try to fold them.
Marie Kondo is an expert in tidying.
So that they will be able to stand upright on their own.
Here she is explaining right. The best way to fold a T-shirt. Her books, which advise people on the best way to declutter their homes and their lives, have sold millions. She's a star of a hit show on Netflix, and her company helps individuals organise limited space. Key to Marie Kondo's philosophy is getting rid of things. She thinks people should keep only those items that speak to the heart and spark joy. Well, the tidying consultant has now launched a new venture that appears to take the opposite approach.
Hi, I'm Marie Kondo. I'm so excited to introduce...
She's launched an online shop that sells things to fill up those freshly decluttered homes. A as a tuning fork for $50 and a brush for crumbs costing $24. Marie Kondo endorsed products do not come cheap. A pair of leather room shoes cost $206. Perhaps unsurprisingly, there's some cynicism about a tidying expert suddenly selling us stuff. But Marie Kondo said the goal of tidying was not simply to get rid of things, but to make more room for meaningful objects that bring us happiness.
The well-organised and minimalist Michael Bristow. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast, all one word, at bbc.co.uk. I'm Joe Lynham. Until next time, goodbye.
Hello, Jackie here, just reminding you about the Happy News Pod. I want to hear your happiest moments of the year. Just record yourself telling us your name, where you are, and one sentence explaining what was the thing that made 2019 sparkle for you. Then attach it to an email and send it to our normal email address, globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. And while you're at it, perhaps include a photo of yourself, or the view where you listen to the Global News Podcast, or the happy thing itself, or a dog, or a kitten or something, I don't know. Quite apart from anything else, it is cheering us up no end here. The Happy News Pod will be available on December the 25th. Thank you all.